right, welcome back. So this is week four, the beginning thereof already. And you'll recall that last week we put code aside for just a little bit and we started talking a little more high level about things like searching and sorting, which though somewhat simple ideas are representative of a class of problems you will begin to solve, particularly as you start thinking about final projects and interesting solutions you might have to real world problems. Now, bubble sort was one of the simplest such algorithms, and it worked by having these small numbers in a list or an array kind of bubble their way up to the top, and the big numbers move their way down to the end of that list. And recall that we could visualize bubble sort a little something like this. So let me go ahead and click start. I've pre-selected bubble sort. And if you recall that the taller blue lines represent big numbers, small blue lines represent small numbers, as we go through this again and again and again, comparing two bars next to each other in red, we're going to swap the biggest and the smallest if they are out of order. So this will go on and go on and go on, and you'll see that the larger elements are making their way to the right and the smaller elements are making their way to the left. But we began to quantify the efficiency, the quality of this algorithm. And we said that in the worst case, this algorithm took roughly how many steps? So n squared. And what was n? So n was the number of elements. And so we'll do this often. Anytime we want to talk about the size of a problem or the size of an input or the amount of time it takes to produce output, we'll just generalize whatever the input is as n. So back in week zero, the number of pages in the phone book was n. The number of students in the room was n. So here, too, we're following that pattern. Now, n squared isn't particularly fast. So we tried to do better. And so we looked at a couple of other algorithms, among which were selection sort. So selection sort was a little different. And it was almost simpler, I dare say, whereby I started at the start of the list of our volunteers, and I just again and again and again went through the list, plucking out the smallest element at a time and putting him or her at the beginning of the list. But this too, once we started to think through the math and bigger picture, thought about how many times I was going back and forth and back and forth, we said in the worst case, selection sort too was what? N squared. Now, in the real world, it might actually be marginally faster, because again, I didn't have to keep backtracking once I had sorted these smallest elements. But if we think about very large n, and if you sort of do out the math as I did on the board with the n squared minus something, everything else besides the n squared, once n gets really large, doesn't really matter as much. So as computer scientists, we sort of turn a blind eye to the smaller factors and focus only on the factor in an expression that's going to make the biggest difference. Well, lastly, we looked at insertion sort. And this was similar in spirit, but rather than go through iteratively and select the smallest element one at a time, I instead took the hand that I was dealt, and I decided, all right, you belong here. Then I moved on to the next element and decided that he or she belonged here. And then I moved on and on. And I might have to, along the way, shift these guys in order to make room for them. So that was sort of the mental reversal of selection sort that we called insertion sort. So these topics do occur in the real world. Just a few years ago, when a certain senator was running for president, Eric Schmidt, at the time the CEO of Google, actually had the opportunity to interview him. And we thought we'd share this YouTube clip for you here, if we could turn up the volume.
Now, Senator, you're here at Google, and I like to think of the presidency as a job interview. Now, it's hard to get a job
right.
as president.
Right.
And I mean, you're going through the rigors now. It's also hard to get a job at Google.
Right.
We have questions, and we ask our candidates questions. And this one is from Larry Schwimmer.
Okay.
You guys think I'm kidding? It's right here. What is the most efficient way to sort 1 million 32-bit integers?
Well, I think the bubble sort would be the wrong way to go.
Come on, who told him this? Okay. I didn't see computer.
So there you have it. So we began to quantify these running times, so to speak, with something called asymptotic notation, which is just referring to our sort of turning a blind eye to those smaller factors and only looking at the running time, the performance of these algorithms as n gets really large over time. And so we introduced big O. And big O represented something like that we thought of as an upper bound. And actually, Barry, could we lower the mic a little bit? We thought of this as an upper bound. So big O of n squared means that in the worst case, something like selection sort would take n squared steps, or something like insertion sort would take n squared steps. Now, for something like insertion sort, what was the worst case, given an array, what's the worst possible scenario that you might find yourself faced with? It's completely backwards, right? Because if it's completely backwards, you have to do a whole lot of work. Because if you're completely backwards, you're going to find the biggest element here, even though it belongs down there. So you're going to say, all right, at this moment in time, you belong here. So you leave it alone. Then you realize, oh, damn, I have to move this slightly smaller element to the left of you. Then I have to do that again and again and again. And if I walked back and forth, you would sort of feel the performance of that algorithm, because constantly am I shuffling everyone else down in the array to make room for it. So that's the worst case. By contrast, and this was a cliffhanger last time, we said that insertion sort was an omega of what? What's the best case running time of insertion sort? So it's actually n. That was the blank that we left on the board last time. And it's omega of n because why? Well, in the very best case, what's insertion sort going to be handed? Well, a list that's completely sorted already, minimal work to do. But what's neat about insertion sort is that because it starts here and decides, oh, you are the number one, you belong here. Oh, what a good fortune, you're the number two, you also belong here. Number three, even better, you belong here. As soon as it gets to the end of the list, per insertion sort's pseudocode that we walked through verbally last time, it's done. But selection sort, by contrast, kept doing what? Kept going through the list again and again and again, because the key insight there was only once you've looked all the way to the end of the list can you be certain that the element you selected was indeed the currently smallest element. So these different mental models end up yielding some very real-world differences for us, as well as these theoretical asymptotic differences. So just to recap then, big O of n squared, we've seen a few such algorithms thus far. Big O of n, what's an algorithm that could be said to be in big O of n? In the worst case, it takes a linear number of steps. Okay, linear search. And in the worst case, where is the element you're looking for when applying linear search? Okay, in the worst case, it's not even there. Or in the second worst case, it's all the way in the end, which is plus or minus a one step difference. So at the end of the day, we can say it's linear. Big O of n would be linear search, because in the worst case, the element's not even there, or it's all the way at the end. Well, a big O of log of n. We didn't talk in great detail about this, but we've seen this before. What runs in so-called logarithmic time in the worst case? Yeah, so binary search. In binary search, in the worst case, might have the element somewhere in the middle or somewhere inside the array, but you only find it once you divide the list in half and half and half and half, and then voila, it's there. Or again, worst case, it's not even there. But you don't know that it's not there until you sort of reach that last bottommost element by having and having and having. Big O of 1. So we could say big O of 2, big O of 3. Anytime you want just a constant number, we just sort of simplify that as big O of 1, even though if realistically it takes 2 or even 100 steps. If it's a constant number of steps, we just say big O of 1. What's an algorithm that's in big O of 1? Finding the length of a variable. Good. Okay, so finding the length of something if the length of that something, like an array, is stored in some variable. Because you can just read the variable or print the variable or just generally access that variable, and voila, that takes constant time. By contrast, think back to Scratch. Think back to the first week of C. Calling just printf and printing something on the screen is arguably constant time, because it just takes some number of CPU cycles to show that text on the screen. Or wait, does it? How else might we model the performance of printf? Would someone like to disagree that maybe it's not really constant time? In what sense might printf's running time, actually printing a string on the screen, be something other than constant? Yeah, so it depends on our perspective. If we actually think of this input to printf as being the string, and therefore we measure the size of that input by its length, so let's call that length n as well, arguably printf is itself big O of n, because it's going to take you n steps to print out each of those n characters, most likely, at least to the extent that we assume that maybe it's using a for loop underneath the hood. But we would have to look at that code to understand it better. And indeed, once you guys start analyzing your own algorithms, you'll literally do just that, sort of eyeball your code and think about, all right, I have this loop here, or I have a nested loop here that's going to do n things n times. And you can sort of reason your way through the code, even if it's pseudocode and not actual code. So what about omega of n squared? What was an algorithm that in the best case still took n squared steps? Yeah. So selection sort, because in that problem really reduced to the fact that, again, I don't know I found the current smallest until I've checked all the darn elements. So omega of, say, n, we just came up with one. insertion sort, if the list happens to be sorted already, in the best case, we just have to make one pass through it, at which point we're sure, and then that could be said to be linear for sure. What about omega of 1? What, in the best case, might take a constant number of steps? So linear search, if you just get lucky and the element you're looking for is right at the beginning of the list, if that's where you're starting your linear traversal of that list. And this falls in, this is true of a number of things. For instance, even binary search is omega of 1, because what if you get really darn lucky and smack dab in the middle of your array is the number you're looking for? So you can get lucky there as well. This one, lastly, omega of n log n. So n log n, we didn't really talk about yet, but merge sort. That was the cliffhanger of last time where we proposed and we showed visually that there are algorithms. And merge sort is just one such algorithm that is fundamentally faster than some of these other guys. In fact, merge sort is not only in the worst in the best case n log n, in the worst case n log n. And when you have this coincidence of omega and O, big O, being the same thing, we can actually describe that as what's called theta, though it's less, a little less common. But that just means the two bounds in this case are the same. So merge sort, what does this really boil down to for us? Well, recall the motivation. Let me pull up another animation that we didn't look at last time. This one, same idea, but it's a little larger. And I'm going to go ahead and point out first, we have insertion sort on the top left, then selection sort, bubble sort, a couple of other sorts, shell and quick that we haven't talked about, and heap and merge sort. So at least try to focus your eyes on the top three on the left, and then merge sort when I click this green arrow. But I'll let all of them run just to give you a sense of the diversity of algorithms that exist in the world. And we'll let this run for just a few seconds. And if you focus your eyes, pick an algorithm, focus on it for just a few seconds, you'll begin to see the pattern that it's implementing. Merge sort, notice, is done. Heap sort, quick show. So it seems we introduced the three worst algorithms last week. But that's good that we're here today to look at merge sort, which is one of the easier ones to look at, even though it probably will bend your mind just a little bit. Here we can see just how much selection sort sucks. But on the flip side, it's really easy to implement. And maybe for PSET 3, that's one of the algorithms you chose to implement for the standard edition. Perfectly fine, perfectly correct. But again, as n gets large, if you choose to implement a faster algorithm like merge sort, odds are for in larger and larger inputs, your code's just going to run faster, your website's going to work better, your users are going to be happier. And so there are these effects of actually giving this some deeper thought. So let's take a look at what merge sort is actually all about. The cool thing is that merge sort is just this. This is, again, what we've called pseudocode, pseudocode being English-like syntax. And the simplicity is sort of fascinating. So on input of n elements, so that just means here's an array, it's got n things in it. That's all we're saying there. If n is less than 2, return. So that's just the trivial case. If n is less than 2, then obviously it's 1 or 0, in which case the thing is already sorted or non-existent, so just return. There's nothing to do. So that's a simple case to pluck off. Else, we have three steps. Sort the left half of the elements, sort the right half of the elements, and then merge the sorted halves. What's interesting here is that I'm kind of punting, right? There's kind of a circular definition to this algorithm. In what sense is this algorithm's definition circular? Yeah, my sorting algorithm, two of its steps are sort something. And so that begs the question, well, what am I going to use to sort the left half and the right half? And the beauty here is that, even though, again, this is the mind-bending part potentially, you can use the same algorithm to sort the left half. But wait a minute, when you're told to sort the left half, what are the two steps going to be next? We'll sort the left half of the left half and the right half of the left half. Damn, how do I sort those two halves or quarters now? But that's OK. We have a sorting algorithm here. And even though you might worry at first, this is kind of an infinite loop. It's a cycle that's never going to end. It is going to end once what happens? Once n is less than 2, which eventually is going to happen, because if you keep having and having and having these halves, surely eventually you're going to end up with just 1 or 0 elements, at which point this algorithm says you're done. So the real magic in this algorithm seems to be in that final step, merging. This simple idea of just merging two things, it's what's ultimately going to allow us to sort an array of, let's say, 8 elements. So I have 8 more stress balls up here, 8 pieces of paper, and 1 Google Glass, which I get to keep. If we could take 8 volunteers, and let's see if we can play this out. So, wow, OK, this is computer science is getting fun. All right, so how about you 3, biggest hand up there, 4 in the back, and how about we'll do you 3 in this row, and 4 in the front. So you 8, come on up. I'm actually not sure what it is. Is it the stress balls, the desk lamps, the material, the internet? Okay, so come on up. Who would like to keep coming up? Let's see. And this puts you in location. You're in location one. Uh-oh, wait a minute. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Oh, good. All right, we're good. All right, so everyone have a seat, but not on the Google Glass. Let me cue these up. What's your name?
Michelle.
Michelle. All right, you get to look like the geek, if that's okay. Well, I do too, I suppose, for just a moment. All right, stand by. We've been trying to come up with a use case for Google Glass, and we thought it would be fun to just do this when people are on stage. We will record the world from their perspective. All right, not probably what Google intended. All right, if you don't mind wearing this for the next few awkward minutes, that would be wonderful. All right, so we have here an array of elements, and that array, as per the pieces of paper in these folks' hands, is currently unsorted. It's pretty much random. And in just a moment, we're going to try to implement merge sort together and see where that key insight is. And the trick here with merge sort is something that we haven't assumed yet. We actually need some additional space. So what's going to be particularly interesting about this is that these guys are going to have to move around a little bit, because I'm going to assume that there's an extra array of space, say, right behind them. So if they're behind their chair, that's the secondary array. If they're seated here, that's the primary array. But this is a resource that we have not leveraged thus far with bubble sort, with selection sort, with insertion sort. Recall last week, everyone just kind of shuffled in place. They didn't use any additional memory. We made room for people by moving people around. So this is a key insight, too. There's this trade-off in general in computer science of resources. If you want to speed up something like time, you're going to have to pay a price. And one of those prices is very often space, the amount of memory or hard disk space that you're using, or frankly, the amount of programmer time, how much time it takes you, the human, to actually implement some more complicated algorithm. But for today, the trade-off is time and space. So if you guys could just hold up your numbers so we can see that you're indeed matching 4, 2, 6, 1, 3, 7, 5, 8. Excellent. So I'm going to try to orchestrate things if you guys can just follow my lead here. So I am going to implement first the first step of the pseudocode, which is on input of n elements as n is less than 2, then return. Obviously, that doesn't apply, so we move on. So sort the left half of the elements. So that means I'm going to focus my attention for just a moment on these four guys here. All right, what do I next do? So now I have to sort the left half of these guys. Because again, assume to yourself the goal is to sort the left half. How do you do that? Just follow the instructions, even though we're doing it again. So sort the left half. Now I'm sorting these two guys. What comes next? Sort the left half. So now this seat here is a list of size 1. And what's your name again? Princess Daisy is here. And so she is already sorted because the list is of size 1. What do I next do? OK, return, because that list is of size 1, which is less than 2. Then what's the next step? And now you have to kind of backtrack in your mind. Sort the right half, which is
Linda.
And so what do we do now that we have a list of size 1? Careful. Well, we return first. And now the third step, and if I kind of depict it by embracing the two seats now I have to merge these two elements. So now, unfortunately, the elements are out of order, but that's where the merging process starts to get compelling. So if you guys could stand up for just a moment, I'm going to need you in a moment to step behind your chair. And if Linda, because 2 is smaller than 4, why don't you come around first? You stay there. So Linda, you come around first. Now, in reality, if it's just an array, we could just move her in real time from this chair to this spot. So imagine that took some constant number of steps 1. And now, but we need to put you in the first location here. And now, if you could come around as well, we're going to be in location 2. And even though this feels like it's taking a while, what's nice now is that the left half of the left half is now sorted. So what was the next step if we now rewind further in the story? Sort the right half. So you guys have to do this as well. So if you could stand up for just a moment. And what's your name?
Jess.
OK, so Jess is now the left half of the right half. And so she's a list of size 1. She's obviously sorted. And your name again?
Michelle.
Michelle is obviously a list of size 1. She's already sorted. So now the magic happens, the merging process. So who's going to come first? Obviously, Michelle. So if you could come around back. The space we have available for her now is right behind this chair here. And now if you could come back as well. We now have, to be clear, 2 halves, each of size 2. And just for depiction's sake, if you could make a little bit of a space, 1 left half here, 1 right half here. Rewind further in the story. What step is next? So now we have to merge. So OK, so now thankfully we just freed up 4 chairs. So we've used twice as much memory, but we can keep flip-flopping between the 2 arrays. So which number has to come first? So Michelle, obviously, so come around and take your seat here. And then number 2 is obviously next. So you come here, number 4, number 6. And again, even though there's a little bit of walking involved, really, these could happen instantly by moving one. OK, well played. And now we're in pretty good shape. The left half of the entire input has now been sorted. All right, so these guys had the advantage of my, how did it end up all the girls on the left and all the boys on the right? OK, so guys' turn now. So I won't walk you through these steps. We'll see if we can reapply the same pseudocode. If you want to go ahead and stand up, and you guys, let me give you the mic, see if you can't replicate what we just did here on the other end of the list. Who needs to speak first based on the algorithm? All right, so explain what you're doing before you make any foot movements.
All right, so since I am the left half of the left, I return right.
Good.
Okay, and then.
Who does the mic go to next?
Next number.
So I'm the right half of the left half of the left half, and I return.
Good, you return. So okay. Now what's the next step for you two?
We want to see who's smaller.
Exactly. We want to merge. The space we're going to use to merge you into, even though they're obviously sorted already, we're still going to follow the same algorithm. So who goes in back first? So 3. And then 7. And now the mic goes to these guys. Okay?
So I'm the right half of the left half. And my n is less than 1, so I'm just going to pass it down.
Good.
I'm the right half of the right half of the right half. And I'm also one person. So I'm going to return. So now we merge. So
we go back.
So you go into the back. Okay. So 5 goes first, then 8. And now, audience, which is the step we have to now rewind back to in our minds? Merging left half and right half of the original left half. So now we have, and just to make this clear, make a little bit of space between you two guys. So now that's the 2 lists, left and right. So how do we now merge you guys into the front row of seats again?
First
3 goes first, then 5, obviously. Then 7, and now 8. OK, and now we are not done, because obviously there's one step remaining. But again, the reason I'm using this jargon, like rewind in your mind, is because that's really what's happening. We're going through all of these steps, but we're sort of pausing for a moment, diving deeper into the algorithm, pausing for a moment, diving deeper into the algorithm. And now we have to sort of rewind in our minds and undo all of these layers that we've sort of put on hold. So now we have 2 lists of size 4. If you guys could stand up one last time and make a bit of space here to make clear that this is the left half of the original, the right half of the original. Who's the first number that we need to pull into the back? Michelle, of course. So we put Michelle here. And who has number 2? Number 2 comes on back as well. Number 3. Excellent. Number 4. Number 5, number 6, number 7, and number 8. OK, so felt like a lot of steps for sure. But now let's see if we can't confirm sort of intuitively that this algorithm fundamentally, particularly as n gets really large, as we've seen with the animations, is fundamentally faster. So I claim this algorithm, in the worst case and even in the best case, is big O of n times log n. That is, there's some aspect of this algorithm that takes n steps, but there's another aspect somewhere in that iteration, that looping, that takes log n steps. Can we put our finger on what those 2 numbers are referring to? Well, where have we taken? Yeah. Where'd the mic go?
Would the log n be breaking us up into 2, 2, 2? Oh, breaking up, dividing by 2, essentially.
Exactly. Any time we see in any algorithm thus far, there's been this pattern of dividing, dividing, dividing. And it's typically reduced to something that's logarithmic, log base 2. But it could really be anything. But log base 2. Now, what about the n? I can see that we kind of divided you guys, divided you, divided you, divided you. Where does the n come from? So it's the merging. Because think about it. When you merge 8 people together, whereby half of them are a set of 4 and the other half are another set of 4, how do you go about doing the merging? Well, you guys did it fairly intuitively. But if I instead did it a little more methodically, I might have pointed at the leftmost person first with my left hand, pointed at the leftmost person of that half with my right hand, and just subsequently walked through the list and pointing at the smallest element each time, moving my finger over and over as needed throughout the list. But what's key about this merging process is I'm comparing these pairs of elements from the left half, from the right half, and from the left half. I'm never once backtracking. So the merge itself is taking no more than n steps. And how many times did I have to do that merging? Well, no more than n. And we just saw that with the final merge. And so if you do something something that takes log n steps n times, or vice versa, it's going to give us n times log n. And why is this better? Well, if we already know that log n is better than n, right? We saw in binary search, the phone book example, log n was definitely better than linear. So that means n times log n is definitely better than n times another n, aka n squared. And that's what we ultimately feel. So a big round of applause, if we could, for these guys. And your parting gifts, you may keep the numbers if you would like. And your parting gift, as usual. Oh, and we will send you the footage, Michelle. Thank you. All right, help yourself to a stress ball. And let me pull up, in the meantime, our friend Rob Bowden to offer a somewhat different perspective on this, since you can think about these steps happening in a somewhat different way. In fact, the setup for what Rob's about to show us assumes that we've already done the dividing up of the big list into 8 small lists, each of size 1. So we're changing the pseudocode a little bit just to sort of get at the core idea of how the merging works. But the running time of what he's about to do is still going to be the same. And again, the setup here is that he's begun with 8 lists of size 1. So you've missed the part where he's actually done the log n, log n, log n dividing of the input.
That's it for step 1. For step 2, you repeatedly merge pairs of lists using the merge algorithm.
Only audio is coming out of my computer. Let's try this again.
Just arbitrarily pick which. Now we have 4 lists.
Okay.
Learned before.
There we go.
Merging 108 and 15, we end up with the list 15, 108. Merging 50 and 4, we end up with 4, 50. Merging 8 and 42, we end up with 8, 42. And merging 23 and 16, we end up with 16, 23. Now all our lists are of size 2. Notice that each of the 4 lists is sorted. So we can start merging pairs of lists again. Merging 15 and 108 and 4 and 50, we first take the 4, then the 15, then the 50, then the 108. Merging 842 and 1623, we first take the 8, then the 16, then the 23, then the 42. So now we have just 2 lists of size 4, each of which is sorted. So now we merge these 2 lists. First, we take the 4, then we take the 8, then we take the 15, then 16, then 23, then 42, then 50, and 108.
He never touched a given cup more than 1 time after advancing beyond it. So he's never repeating. So he's always moving to the side. And that's where we got our n. Why don't let me pull up 1 animation that we saw earlier, but this time focusing only on merge sort. Let me go ahead and zoom in on this here. First, let me choose a random input, magnify this. And you can sort of see what we took for granted earlier merge sort is actually doing. So notice that you get these halves, or these quarters, or these eighths of the problem that all of a sudden start to take good shape. And then finally, you see at the very end that, bam, everything is merged together. So these are just 3 different takes on the same idea. But the key insight, just like divide and conquer in the very first class, was that we decided to somehow divide the problem into something big, into something sort of identical in spirit, but smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, another fun way to sort of think about these, even though it's not going to give you the same intuitive understanding, is the following animation. So this is a video someone put together that associated different sounds with the various operations for insertion sort, for merge sort, and for a couple of others. So in a moment, I'm going to hit play. It's about 1 minute long. And even though you can still see the patterns happening, this time you can also hear how these algorithms are performing differently and with somewhat different patterns. Sort. It again is trying to insert each element into where it belongs. This is bubble sort. how relatively little work it's doing on each step. This is what tediousness sounds like. This is selection sort, where we select the element we want by going through again and again and again and putting it at the beginning. This is merge sort, which you can really start to feel. Something called gnome sort, which we haven't looked at. So let me see now, distracted as you hopefully are by the music, if I can slip a little bit of math in here. So there's a fourth way that we can think about what it means for these functions to be faster than ones that we've seen before. And if you're coming at the course from a mathematics background, you actually know perhaps already that you can slap a term on this technique, namely recursion. So a function that somehow calls itself. And again, recall that merge sort pseudocode was recursive in the sense that one of merge sort's steps was to call sort, that is, itself. But thankfully, because we kept calling sort, or merge sort specifically, on a smaller and smaller and smaller list, we eventually bottomed out thanks to what we'll call a base case, the hard-coded case that said if the list is small, less than 2 in that case, just return immediately. If we didn't have that special case, the algorithm would never bottom out, and you would indeed get into an infinite loop truly forever. But suppose that we wanted to now put some numbers on this, again using n as the size of the input, and I wanted to ask you, what's the total time involved in running merge sort? Or more generally, what's the cost of it in time? Well, it's pretty easy to measure that. If n is less than 2, the time involved in sorting n elements, where n is 2, is 0, because we just return. There's no work to be done. Now, arguably, maybe it's one step or two steps to figure out the amount of work, but it's close enough to 0 that I'm just going to say no work is required if the list is so small to be uninteresting. But this case is interesting. The recursive case was the branch of the pseudocode that said else sort the left half, sort the right half, merge the two halves. Now, why does this expression represent that expense? Well, t of n just means the time to sort n elements. And then on the right-hand side of the equal sign there, the t of n divided by 2 is referring to the cost of what? Sorting the left half. The other t of n divided by 2 is presumably referring to the cost to sort the right half. And then the plus n is the merging. Because if you have two lists, one of size n over 2 and another of size n over 2, you have to essentially touch each of those elements, just like Rob touched each of the cups, and just as we pointed at each of the volunteers on stage, so n is the expense of merging. Now, unfortunately, this formula is also itself recursive. So if asked the question, if n is, say, 16, if there's 16 people on stage or 16 cups in the video, how many total steps does it take to sort them with merge sort? It's actually not an obvious answer, because now you have to sort of recursively answer this formula. But that's okay, because let me propose that we do the following. The time involved to sort 16 people, or 16 cups, is going to be represented generally as t of 16. But that equals, according to our previous formula, 2 times the amount of time it takes to sort 8 cups plus 16. And again, plus 16 is the time to merge, and the 2 times t of 8 is the time to sort left half and right half. But again, this isn't enough. We have to dive in deeper. This means we have to answer the question, what is t of 8? Well, t of 8 is just 2 times t of 4 plus 8. Well, what's t of 4? T of 4 is just 2 times t of 2 plus 4. Well, what's t of 2? T of 2 is just 2 times t of 1 plus 2. And again, we're kind of getting stuck in this cycle, but it's about to hit that so-called base case. Because what's t of 1, did we claim? 0. So now finally we can work backwards. If t of 1 is 0, I can now go back up one line to this guy here, and I can plug in 0 for t of 1. So that means it equals 2 times 0, otherwise known as 0, plus 2. And so that whole expression is 2. Now if I take the t of 2, whose answer is 2, plug it into the middle line, t of 4, that gives me 2 times 2 plus 4, so 8. If I then plug in 8 to the previous line, that gives me 2 times 8, 16. And if we then continue that with the 24, adding in 16, we finally get a value of 64. Now, that in and of itself sort of speaks nothing to the n notation, the big O, the omega that we've been talking about. But it turns out that 64 is indeed 16, the size of the input, log base 2 of 16. And if this is a little unfamiliar, just think back, and it'll come back to you eventually. If this is log base 2, it's like 2 raised to the what gives you 16? Oh, that's 4. So it's 16 times 4. And again, it's not a big deal if this is sort of a hazy memory now. But for now, take on faith that 16 log 16 is 64. And so indeed, with this simple sanity check, we've confirmed, but not proved formally, that the running time of merge sort is indeed n log n. So not bad. It's definitely better than the algorithms we've seen thus far. And it's because we've leveraged, one, a technique called recursion, but more interesting than that, that notion of dividing and conquering. Again, truly week zero stuff that even now is recurring in a more compelling way. Now, a fun little exercise, if you've never done this, and you probably wouldn't have, because sort of normal people don't think to do this, but if I go to google.com, and if I want to learn something about recursion, enter. Bad joke slowly spreading. Just in case, it's there. I didn't spell it wrong, and there's a joke. All right. Explain it to the people next to you if it hasn't quite clicked just yet. But recursion, more generally, refers to the process of a function calling itself, or more generally, dividing a problem into something that can be solved piecemeal by solving identical representative problems. Well, let's change gears for just a moment. We like to end on certain cliffhangers, so let's start to set the stage for several minutes on a very simple idea, that of swapping two elements, right? All of these algorithms that we've been talking about the past couple of lectures involve some sort of swapping. Today it was visualized by them getting up out of their chairs and walking around, but in code we would just take an element from one array and plop it into another. So how do we go about doing this? Well, let me go ahead and write a quick program here. I'm going to go ahead and do this as the following. Let's call this, what do we want to call this one? Actually, no. Let me rewind. I don't want to do that cliffhanger yet. It will spoil the fun. Let's do this instead. Suppose that I want to write a little program that now embraces this idea of recursion. I kind of got ahead of myself there. I'm going to do the following. First, a quick include of standard io.h, as well as an include of cs50.h. And then I'm going to go ahead and declare int main void in the usual way. I realized I misnamed the file, so let me just add a .c extension here so that we can compile it properly. Start this function off. And the function I want to write quite simply is one that asks the user for a number and then adds up all the numbers between that number and some, and say, 0. So first, I'm going to go ahead and declare int n. And then I'm going to copy some code that we've used for a while something is true. I'll come back to that in a moment. What do I want to do? I want to say printf positive integer please. And then I'm going to say n gets get int. So again, some boilerplate code that we've used before. And I'm going to do this while n is less than 1. So this will ensure that the user gives me a positive integer. And now I'm going to do the following. I want to add up all of the numbers between 1 and n, or 0 and n equivalently, to get the total sum, so the big sigma symbol that you might recall. So I'm going to do this by first calling a function called sigma, passing it in n, and then I'm going to say printf, the answer is right there. So in short, I get an int from the user, I ensure it's positive. I declare a variable called answer of type int and store in it the return value of sigma, passing in n as input, and then I print out that answer. Unfortunately, even though sigma sounds like something that might be in the math .h header file, its declaration, it's actually not. So that's OK. I can implement this myself. I'm going to implement a function called sigma, and it's going to take a parameter, let's just call it m, just so it's different. And then up here, I'm going to say, well, if m is less than 1, this is a very uninteresting program. So I'm going to go ahead and immediately return 0. It just doesn't make sense to add up all the numbers between 1 and m if m is itself 0 or negative. And then I'm going to go ahead and do this very iteratively. I'm going to do this sort of old school. And I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm going to declare a sum to be 0. And then I'm going to have a for loop of int and words. Let me do it to match our distribution code. So you have a copy at home. Int I gets 1 on up to I is less than or equal to M, I plus plus. And then inside of this for loop, we're almost there, sum gets sum plus 1. And then I'm going to return the sum. So I did this quickly, quite admittedly. But again, the main function is pretty straightforward based on code we've written thus far. It uses the do while loop to get a positive int from the user. I then pass that int to a new function called sigma, calling it again n. And I store the return value, the answer from the black box currently known as sigma, in a variable called answer. Then I print it. If we now continue the story, how is sigma implemented? I propose to implement it as follows. First, a little bit of error checking to make sure that the user's not messing with me and passing in some negative or zero value. Then I declare a variable called sum and set it to 0. And now I begin to move from I equals 1 all the way up to and including m, because I want to include all the numbers from 1 through m inclusive. And inside of this for loop, I just do sum, gets whatever it is now, plus the value of plus the value of i. As an aside, if you've not seen this before, there's some syntactic sugar for this line. I can rewrite this as plus equals I just to save myself a few keystrokes and to look a bit cooler. But that's all. It's functionally the same thing. Unfortunately, this code's not going to compile yet. If I run make sigma 0, how am I going to get yelled at? What's it going to not like? Yeah, I didn't declare the function up top, right? C is kind of stupid in that it only does what you tell it to do, and you have to do it in that order. And so if I hit enter here, I'm going to get a warning about sigma implicit declaration. Oh, not a problem. I can go up to the top, and I can say, all right, wait a minute. Sigma is a function that returns an int, and it expects an int as input, semicolon. Or I could put the whole function above main. But in general, I'd recommend against that, because it's nice to always have main at the top so you can dive right in and know what a program's doing by reading main first. So now let me clear the screen, remake sigma 0. All seems to check out. Let me run sigma 0. Positive enter. I'll give it the number 3 to keep it simple. So that should give me 3 plus 2 plus 1, so 6. Enter. And indeed, I get 6. I can do something bigger, 50. 1275. Just as a tangent, I'm going to do something ridiculous, like a really big number. Well, that actually worked out. I don't think that's right. Let's see. Let's really mess with it. That's a problem. What's going on? The code's not that bad. It's still linear. Whistling is a good effect, though. What's going on? I'm not sure if I heard it. So it turns out, and this is as an aside, this is not core to the idea of recursion. It turns out because I'm trying to represent such a big number, most likely it's being misinterpreted by C as a not positive number, but negative number. We have not talked about this, but it turns out there are negative numbers in the world in addition to positive numbers. And the means by which you can represent a negative number essentially is you use one special bit to indicate positive or negative. It's a little more complex than that, but that's the basic idea. So unfortunately, if C is confusing one of those bits as actually meaning, oh, this is a negative number, my loop here, for instance, is actually never going to terminate. So if I were actually printing something again and again, we would see a whole lot. But again, this is besides the point. This is really just a sort of intellectual curiosity that will come back to eventually. But for now, this is a correct implementation if we assume that the user will provide ints that fit within ints. But I claim that this code, frankly, could be done so much more simply. If the goal at hand is to take a number like m and add up all of the numbers between it and 1, or conversely, between 1 and it, I claim that I can borrow this idea that merge sort had, which was taking a problem of this size and dividing it into something smaller. Maybe not half, but smaller, but representatively the same. Same idea, but a smaller problem. So I'm actually, let me save this file with a different version number. We'll call this version 1 instead of 0. And I claim that I can actually re-implement this in this sort of mind-bending way. I'm going to leave part of it alone. If I'm going to say if m is less than or even equal to 0, I'm just going to be a little more anal this time with my error checking. I'm going to go ahead and return 0. This is arbitrary. I am just simply deciding if the user gives me a negative number, I'm returning 0, and they should have read the documentation more closely. Else, notice what I'm going to do. Else, I am going to return m plus, what is sigma of m? Well, sigma of m is m plus m minus 1, plus m minus 2 plus m minus 3. I don't want to write all of that out. Why don't I just punt recursively, call myself with a slightly smaller problem, semicolon, and call it a day? Right now here, too, you might feel or worry that this is an infinite loop that I'm inducing, whereby I am implementing sigma by calling sigma. But that's perfectly OK because I thought ahead and added which lines? 23 to 26, which is my if condition, because what's nice about the subtraction here, because I keep handing sigma smaller problem, smaller problem, smaller. It's not half the size. It's only a baby step smaller, but that's okay, because eventually we'll work our way down to 1 or 0, and once we hit 0, sigma is not going to call itself anymore. It's going to immediately return 0. So the effect, if you sort of wind this up in your mind, is to add m plus m minus 1, plus m minus 2, plus m minus 3, plus dot, 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 m minus m eventually, giving you 0. And the effect is ultimately to add all of these things together. So we have not, with recursion, solved a problem that we couldn't solve before. Indeed, version 0 of this and every problem to date has been solvable with just using for loops or while loops or similar constructs. But recursion, I dare say, gives us a different way of thinking about problems, whereby if we can take a problem, divide it from something somewhat large into something somewhat smaller, I claim that we can solve it perhaps a little more elegantly in terms of the design, with less code, and maybe even solve problems that would be harder, as we'll eventually see, solving purely iteratively. But the cliffhanger that I did want to leave us on was this. Let me go ahead and open up a file from, actually, let me go ahead and do this real fast. Let me go ahead and propose the following. Among today's code is this file here. This one here, no swap. So this is a stupid little program that I whipped up that claims to do the following. In main, it first declares an int called x and assigns it the value 1. Then it declares an int y and assigns it the value 2. Then it prints out what x and y is. Then it says swapping, dot, dot, dot. Then it claims to be calling a function called swap, passing in x and y, the idea of which is that hopefully x and y will come back different, the opposite. Then it claims swapped with an exclamation point. Then it prints out x and y. But it turns out that this very simple demonstration down here is actually buggy. Even though I'm declaring a temporary variable and temporarily putting a in it, then I'm reassigning a the value of b, which feels reasonable because I've saved a copy of a in temp. Then I update b to equal whatever was in temp. This sort of shell game of moving a into b and b into a by using this middleman called temp feels perfectly reasonable. But I claim that when I run this code, as I'll do now, let me go ahead and paste it in here. I'll call this noswap.c. And as the name suggests, this is not going to be a correct program. Make noswap dot slash noswap. X is 1, y is 2. Swapping swapped. X is 1, y is 2. This is fundamentally wrong, even though this seems perfectly reasonable to me. And there is a reason, but we're not going to reveal the reason just yet. For now, the second cliffhanger I wanted to leave you with is this, an announcement of sorts on coupon codes. Our innovation with late days this year has provoked a non-trivial number of questions, which was not our intention. The intention of these coupon codes, whereby if you do part of the problem set early, thereby getting an extra day, was really to help you guys help yourselves start early, sort of by incentivizing you, helps us distribute load across office hours better, so that it's sort of win-win. Unfortunately, I think my instructions have not been to date very clear, so I went back this weekend and updated the spec in bigger, bolder text to explain bullets like these. And just to say it more publicly, by default, problem sets are due at Thursday at noon, per the syllabus. If you start early, finishing part of the problem set by Wednesday at 12 p.m., the part that relates to a coupon code, the idea is that you can extend your deadline for the rest of the PSET until Friday. That is, bite off a tiny part of the PSET relative to what typically is the larger problem, and you buy yourself an extra day. Again, it gets you thinking about the problem set, gets you to office hours sooner, but the coupon code problem is still required, even if you don't submit it. But more compellingly is this. And those folks leaving early are going to regret it. As are the folks on the balcony. I apologize in advance to folks on the balcony for reasons that will be clear in just a moment. So we are fortunate to have one of CS50's former head teaching fellows at a company called Dropbox.com. They have very generously donated a coupon code here for this much space. which is up from the usual 2 gigabytes. So what I thought we would do on this final note is do a bit of a giveaway, whereby in just a moment we will reveal the winner and who has a coupon code that you can then go to their website, type it in, and voila, you get a whole lot more Dropbox space for your clients and for your personal files. And first, who would like to participate in this drawing? Okay, now that makes it even more fun. The answer to the person who receives this 25 gigabyte coupon code, which is far more compelling than the late days now, perhaps, is the one who is seated on top of a seat cushion beneath which there is that coupon code. You may now look underneath your seat cushion.
Open your boxes. 1, 2, 3.
We will see you on Wednesday. Balcony folks, come down here to the front where we have extras.
At the next CS50,